Welcome to the Crown Council Mentor of the Month program. This is Steve Anderson. Within the Mentor of the Month program, we occasionally invite accomplished Crown Council members to share what we call 20 things that have made me a better dentist, in an effort to perpetuate the philosophy that it's a lot easier to copy genius than it is to create mediocrity. Today, we'll hope you'll sit up, take notice, and copy some of the wisdom and genius of one of the Crown Council's longest-term members, Dr. Jim Hyland. Dr. Hyland was born in Ireland and moved to Canada in 1957. At age 13, he decided to be a dentist. He's a graduate of the University of Toronto and has taught at George Brown College, Seneca College, and the University of Toronto. He started in private practice in 1976 and began setting the standard by being one of the first dentists in Canada to use the cochlearing light, the first in Ontario to place computers in treatment rooms, use air abrasion, and use the water lays. In 2006, he was the first dentist to start an oral vital breath clinic and adapted it to include perio treatment using microbiological testing of biofilms. Dr. Hyland continues to be a trendsetter in dentistry by continually implementing the latest technologies and combining them with the culture of success espoused in the Crown Council. We're pleased to have Dr. Jim Hyland as this month's Crown Council Mentor of the Month to share 20 things that have made him a better dentist. Dr. Hyland, welcome.
Thank you, Steve, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to my colleagues. I really feel honored to be asked to participate, and I hope that, as you say, some of the things that we've learned can ease the path for others and perhaps make them more successful in their career as they want to be faster than they might normally be. I have learned most of what I know by, as you say, copying others. And so there is some original stuff, but I do have to give you credit to those that have come before me in giving me a lot of ideas.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing your 20 things. I know that this process is challenging for those that have done it because they have to narrow it down to the real core things that they think have made a difference. So let's get started.
The first thing I did is I wanted to make sure that my patients know that I treat three areas, but I do hundreds of treatments, Steve. We treat biofilms if they are not in the normal range for decay and gum disease. And we try and do it before gum disease and has occurred and decay. I tell patients, for instance, there are two types of cavities, ones they can prevent and ones they can't. Ones they can't are usually on the occlusal surface and in the pits. Ones they can are on the buccal, lingual, and in between. And as you talk, the patient gets to understand it's their choice to prevent disease or to pay the price of damaging them. I tell them we treat stress on teeth that shows up either in clenching and grinding as hard tissue injuries to the teeth or soft tissue injuries to their TMJ complex, and suggest that they wear a night guard if I see damage or recommend referral if it's appropriate. And finally, we treat orthodontics, wisdom teeth removal, cosmetics, snoring, sleep apnea, and these are other areas, but fundamentally we do two treatments, treat biofilms and stress, but we do hundreds of treatments for our patients. And if you put things in perspective, I think they understand where we're coming from. I'd like to think that the focus for dentists might be now to be treating biofilms with the new knowledge and treatments that we have to control pathogenic biofilms in conjunction with all of our traditional methods, because in spite, as you say, of all our efforts, 80% of our patients have bleeding, which is infection, and soreness, which is inflammation. And as you've so aptly mentioned, the oral systemic link is important. And later in the discussion, I'd like to mention five studies that might change the way we look at biofilms and treat them. And these are things that Tommy has talked about and Lisa Marie, and I'd like to emphasize as well. One of the things that I try and do is to do my best on every patient that I see. I remember one time I was treating a patient and she asked if her friend could be with me while I did the care. And I said, certainly. And when I'd finished describing what this patient needed, it was the day before her wedding, she turned to her friend and she said, so what do you think? And the lady said, yes, he's telling you the truth. And I asked, well, who are you? And she said she was a dentist from California and that she was up here in the wedding party. So whether they're poor or you're providing free care or whatever you're doing, try and do your best each time that you're taking care of patients.
You never know who you're talking to, right, Jim?
That's exactly, or who they know. And so
that's
I
right.
think you have to keep that in mind. Just be honest about what you're doing and be upfront, you know. I find that when I'm giving emergency care, either to reactivation patients or a new patient that comes in, consider giving them the big picture on the emergency exam. And I don't mean going into all sorts of detail about their whole mouth. But as you examine, talk out loud for the patient. It will be refreshing. I'll tell them I'm checking for temperature sensitivity because cold means it's reversible. Heat means there's some air pocket perhaps in the tooth, and that might need root canal. If there's pain, that the only thing a tooth feels is pain, and that hot, cold, sweet drilling, everything hurts, and the pain doesn't indicate a severe problem, but don't tell the tooth that. If I'm checking for, I'm telling them I'm checking for pockets and bleeding, decay, wear, looseness as we go along, and that occasionally some x-rays are required. Now, the patient learns a lot and perceives that you're an expert as you're talking, and then I usually, on a posterior tooth, recommend you take a bite wing and a PA, because you need to see the opposing arch for referred pain. And also, if you spend a lot of money fixing a single tooth up top, they may not have the money left to do any care below, and they might want to have known ahead of time that instead of having a diamond above and lumps of coal below, they now have to make some difficult decisions. So advise them on the options for care, and now your three-minute examination had a purpose, and I think they feel as if they got a valuable service. It reminds me of the story of the washing machine guy who came in and asked the lady what was the problem with her washing machine. And she said, it stops working at the cycle. And he said, can you start it up? And she did. And when we got to that part of the cycle, it did stop. And he just leaned over and kicked it. At that point, it started working. And she said, what's this $50 bill for? And he said, well, ma'am, he says, I knew it had to be kicked, and I knew where to kick it. And so if you've explained all these sorts of things, your fees might be a little less of a problem for your patients. So tell them what you do. Ask, don't tell. You know?
That's good. And you don't kick them, right, Jim?
You don't kick them, no. I tell patients they're allowed to kick me, but there's no hitting when I'm working on them. That generally keeps me out of trouble. In practice management, I try and hire slow and collaboratively with the team, Steve. They need to have a stake in the new person coming in. I tell the new hire that the team will judge them because I'm just so easily fooled. I'm concentrating on just wanting to do dentistry and help patients. I try and hire now for attitude and less for an experience. I want them to be open to the new ideas because, as you've said, I adopted a lot of new things early, and I want the team to work with me on that. And the new hires are told I want them to retire with me. So the longer they're with me, I think the more continuous service the patients get, and the easier dentistry is for me. Lately on the CC, we've had a few things about what do you do with new hires and what do you do if they're not working out. And Steve, you guys and Walter always used to talk about having turkey shoots. Fire fast if things aren't on track in the first month. It's inexpensive at this stage. So just a few tips that way. I think you need to take the blame and to give the credit for success to the team. And again, this is all a re-emphasis of Crown Council, but educate the team, a new team player, of everything you know as you're doing dentistry. In the same way, when I'm talking to a new patient, if I have a new hire, I'm discussing the procedure that I'm doing, why I'm choosing what I'm doing, how to fulcrum, why it's important. And you know, your patient's listening to this as you're working, and they get the feeling that you're a teacher, that you care, that you're detailed, and that they're in good hands. And on top of that, your new hire can't help but understand exactly how you'd like to have things done. So they will feel they're in good hands. And you should delegate everything you can, inquire how things are going, and find the time to praise when things are done the way you were. For a new hire, I think this setup works well.
And just a quick follow-up question on that, Jim. When you engage the rest of your team in the hiring process, do they interview the potential new hire as a group, or do they do that individually?
Steve, it depends on the day. I've done it many ways, but there will always be, if it's a hygienist that I'm interviewing, there will be a hygienist with me and my office manager. If it's an assistant, there will be an assistant and an office manager with me. I've only ever had to hire three office managers in 37 years, and I have to tell you, they make practice enjoyable. You need to have one. You don't get paid as much to do ordering supplies and filling out regulatory forms and doing all the things that they do. But the team is with me depending on the situation, and I depend on them sometimes to even do a pre-interview, and if it's warrants, then they call me in. If they don't think it's going to work, they don't even call me in, Steve.
Excellent. All right,
I think you have to set the vision for the patient and the team with them. We're responsible for the standard of practice, and we have to keep the bar high, and it's hard. It's an uphill battle. I discuss with team members, you know, if they're not following the system, be it the proposing operative or standard of care for hygiene, how patients are greeted, how I do a filling, if there's a sequence in the way that I do things. But I'm also willing to change if a better system comes along. And I try and put into action, you know, what we learn, or as you say, the knowledge isn't useful. So set a vision and be responsible for making sure that you you take care of it.
How do you do that for your patient? Because you said you set the vision for the patient and the team. I understand how you do it with the team. How do you do that with a new patient?
What I do with a new patient is I try and I love the show with Jerry Maguire. I think Jerry Maguire, and it was the story of a football agent that was taking care of the football player. And all the football player cared about was what's in it for me. Have you got my contract? How much are you going to earn? He didn't care what Jerry had to do to get him the contract, what it cost him. And ultimately, that's all our patients care about, what's in it for me. So I think you have to find a way to demonstrate to them what's in it for me. And as I mentioned later, for instance, a bleeding point really doesn't demonstrate it. But if you use the bleeding index, they can see. If you can introduce biofilm and biofilm discussion with them, and you can talk to them in a way that every patient will allow you to disclose them, they're shocked when they see the biofilm in their mouth because they truly have done the best they can before they come in to be cleaned. If you can put the bleeding index or bleeding and probing discussion into terms that are visual to them, then they will relate to what you're doing. So, for instance, if I'm doing a bleeding index, bleeding and probing, I'll tell them, you know what? I'm bleeding or probing, this is the score. We want to get 10 points or less. If it's 15, you're an average athlete. If you're 10 or less, you're an Olympic athlete. If you're in the range of 15, you're a competitive athlete. If you're 20, you're an average person. If you're 30, you're a couch potato. If you're 40 or more, you're morbidly obese. Let's see what your score is. Well, now the bleeding and probing means something to them. Nobody wants to be in that 40 category. They now know they had a problem they didn't know ahead of before. They may be more willing to listen to what you're saying. And the same, I'll get into how to, in discussion with oral hygiene, making it fun with the patient. So I think that's what I do to engage new patients, and it works well for me.
So you paint the picture for them beforehand so they understand what they're hearing so that it's not foreign to them. They're discovering it as you're discovering it.
Exactly. In everything that I try and do, you know, before I would test to see if they have bleeding, I describe the bleeding as not normal. Healthy skin never, ever bleeds under any circumstances. If it did, you would go to the hospital. And I tell them, unfortunately, dentists have become too comfortable with bleeding, and so have our patients. And what we need to do is get to the point where your gums don't bleed, that if they bleed, they're infected. And if they hurt, they're inflamed. And my goal is to get to the point where your gums don't bleed and ask them how they feel about that. And there isn't a person that doesn't say they want to eliminate the bleeding.
Got it.
One of my big ones you mentioned at the beginning is be willing to adopt new technologies. Your patient's perception of you changes. Your ability to market your practice is different. And the joy in terms of providing the best care you can for patients is something to go home and feel good about. I know that I had to attend boot camp quite a few times. I did it with every major hire I had for associates and reception, office manager. And you need to just keep going back and reviewing the type of techniques that you talk about. I try and let my mind be on a parachute and to be open to new ideas. And as I mentioned, the Crown Council is a great idea to get feedback on new technologies. There's been big discussions on Cerex, and people have said, well, you know, where can I buy one? And as I mentioned many times, you can avoid buying it when you find out it is or isn't worthwhile. Or you can, at times, for instance, with Cerex, you can buy them overseas and import them, and you'll pay about half the price. And the companies will still be willing to service them because they want your business and the supply orders. One of the things I learned, an interesting story, was not to try and keep up with Dr. Jones. I started doing wisdom tooth surgery early, and I had hospital privileges, and a beautiful oral surgeon taught me to use a chisel to section teeth. And the first Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock, when I was doing it on my own, it happened to be in one of my assistants. I used the chisel, and when I hit the tooth, it disappeared, Steve. It didn't fracture. It went under the tissue and down in under the jaw.
Oof.
So at that point, I felt like Ben Casey. I'm aging myself here, but I started sweating. They started wiping my sweat, and I said, is there an oral surgeon around? They said, no, doctor, you're the dentist. Is there a plastic surgeon around or an ENT? No, doctor, you're the dentist. What are you going to do now? And they just looked at me. And I figured, well, an oral surgeon is just going to make the hole bigger. And I did get the tooth out, Steve. And then they looked at me because that was the first tooth. And they said, what are you going to do with the rest of them? I said, I'm taking them out. She's never coming back to have these taken out. And so at that point, I figured, I'm not doing wisdom teeth anymore. And then I was talking with a friend and who was much less experienced than me. And he told me about the wisdom teeth he was taking out in his office. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to do it anymore because I tried it once and it didn't work, and I didn't want to start keeping up with the Jones, starting to do things that I didn't have good experiences with or that I felt maybe I wasn't as capable of doing as perhaps an oral surgeon. So there are things that you may not want to do, and that's okay. You shouldn't do them because you feel pressured by peers to do things. Do you remember the time that you talked about raising your fees in dentistry? I think it was years ago, Walter mentioned that Kodak had done a study where they looked at what would happen if they raised their fees by 10% and prices, I guess, for them. And the study said that they'd have a 25% increase in income, but probably a 25% drop off in clients. So for a company like Kodak, that wouldn't work. But you guys said, well, try it in dentistry. So I talked to my office manager about it. I talked to her about it. And all the time I'm talking, she's smiling at me. And about 3 months later, I said, go ahead and do it. And she said to me, you didn't know that I did it 2 months ago? And so she had raised the fees on me without me knowing. I didn't pay a lot of attention to that. And the patients didn't care. They didn't say a thing. And all they ended up saying was, he's expensive, but he's good. So if you're worth it and you do the things you're supposed to do, you really can charge more and get away with it, but it's a matter of you feeling that you are worth it. But I think you do have to deliver. The patients have to feel that they're getting for getting what they want.
You know, Jim, you've heard us say a number of times that the patients, no matter what you charge, patients are always going to accuse you of being expensive. So you might as well be it.
And
you're going to get accused of it anyway.
Yeah, and that's what they say. They just said he's expensive, but he's good. And they expect everyone to be expensive, so this is what they say now. I've tried to develop systems for everything, sort of the Walter Deming way, and I tell new hires that we do a lot of dances here, but there's only one way to do the waltz. And if you can improve on my waltz, we can discuss it, but unless you can, we have to do it this way. And the communicating with your patients, I think, have to be much the same. When I see a new patient, if I'm going to discuss why I'm changing an amalgam restoration, then I'm going to, like, turn on a CD and say the same thing to each patient so they get the same information. And you need to do that. I like to use stories and analogies when I'm talking with the patients. And home care instructions, where we seem to have the hardest time, and really you can make it fun. When I see the patients, when I first see them, they truly think that they have done the best they can before they come in for the visit. And when I look in their mouths and see the biofilm, the stain, the calculus, I can't figure out why they don't see what I see, and that's because they're not dentists and they don't have the training. For instance, after I've talked with them, I'll say to them, it's not your fault. It wouldn't matter if you brush twice as long or twice as often, because if you're not reaching where the bacteria are, you can't control this infection that's there. Does that make sense? If you can try and do it in a non-blaming way, ask them, can you show them a better way of cleaning these areas, or, as I say, reaching this area, they will try and do what it is you recommend. Most of us, I mean, we go into patients and we say, have you been flossing? And that's the equivalent of asking an adult, if you went to see the physician, did you shower before you came in today? It just creates a barrier, and those barriers are hard to break down. I try and disclose always. I discuss the biofilms. For instance, I tell them to clean their gums, not their teeth. I tell them after I've disclosed, if you look the biofilms at the gum line, it's not on the top of your teeth. And I tell them if they clean their teeth, they don't clean their gums, but if they clean their gums, they will always clean their teeth. And if you're nodding your head as you do and mimicking their position, they're agreeing with you that they need to change how they're focusing now and to clean their gums, because for the most part, it's gum disease we treat in biofilms, and they aren't on the occlusal surface of the teeth very much. I kid people and tell them, oh, I see the windshield wiper effect. And they say, what's that? I say, well, you ever watch the windshield wiper going back and forth? It always misses a little area in the front. And they go, yeah. I say, well, watch me brushing. And as you swing your brush from the left to the right, it looks like a windshield wiper. And there's always that little spot, lower right for right-handed people, lower left for left, where they never reach down at the gum line on the cuspids and fours. And, I say to them, can I show you how to reach those areas? Or my favorite is taking care of your gums is a lot like cleaning the floor, but the real dirt's under the fridge and stove. And when I say that, they invariably smile, and then I ask them, can I show them how to clean under the fridge and stove? And if it didn't involve flossing, would they be interested? I've yet to hear a person that didn't say, doctor, can you please do that, because I have such trouble with flossing. And we've only got flossing in our arsenal in a lot of cases, and soft picks and stimulants work extremely well to both demonstrate there's bleeding and also to therapeutically to help treat it and disturb the biofilm. Bleeding index is using a soft pick or stimulant to press between, on a right-handed people, the upper first bicuspid and molar, because that's the area they have the hardest time cleaning, because they have to bend their wrist and shoulder over. Tell them ahead of time by rubbing on their nose that healthy skin doesn't hurt, doesn't bleed, and then do it between their teeth and tell them if it bleeds, it's infected, if it hurts, it's sore, and make sure they have a mirror, because you're going to get bleeding. And this is the bleeding that they see after they've had their teeth cleaned, and they blame the hygienist for the cleaning. But if you can demonstrate it before you actually do anything, then they know that they have the problem. And now when I talk about cleaning under the fridge and stove, they understand what I'm talking about. And they're much more interested in pursuing care when they literally see blood pouring down the sulcus and it's not going into the gauze. I tell them it's a transmissible infection, that they could be spreading it to their spouse, that they could be giving it to their children. And at that point, their periodontal condition means more. And this is what I mean by reaching your patients and engaging them and having some fun with home care instruction. It can be fun, actually. It's a form of manipulation, but I enjoy it.
Well, Jim, what we've always said is that the line between persuasion and manipulation is intent.
And this is intent, Steve. And but it just makes your day more fun. The patients open up and they're willing to consider something new. And I think this is something, if the dentist would give a try, the soft picks and stimulants, it's probably one of the biggest tips I could give them in terms of something to use in their arsenal. From here, I've listened to Tom Neighbors and Lisa, and they're talking, and I agree there's our sense of frustration in getting dentists to adopt or consider microbiological testing and anti-biofilm, modalities to control periodontal disease at its early stage. And there were, if you give me a few moments, five articles that I've read in the last few years that have changed my outlook on how I've approached periodontal disease. And to put it in perspective, I want you to think of the way we treat or used to treat ulcers, because our ulcer treatment, I think, at the moment is very similar to the routine perio programs we use. physicians treated the symptoms. They said to take an acid reduction pill. They told the type A personalities to relax. And it took a general practitioner, I think he was in Australia, where he infected and cured himself. And he had to do it three times before the medical profession would accept that ulcers were an infection, which actually come from the mouth. And it took 5 or 6 years before it became generally adopted. So it's not normal for us to start adapting microbiological testing and antibiofilm modalities. That's the norm. But in dentistry, we've got to remember that we have to pull the sliver out and not to be treating the symptoms. And so we have to, the sliver is the biofilm. We have to change its composition. And we've become, as I said, you know, accustomed to bleeding. And the studies that I can go over discuss periodontal disease causing widespread destruction of the body. They emphasize a new approach is needed. And so if you take a look at the AA, American Association of Periodontal Physicians on Systemic Antibiotics 2004, they're advocating in three occasions that microbiological testing is recommended in conjunction with mechanical therapy and appropriate antibiotic use. At that point, they're talking systemic antibiotics. A stunning one for me was periodontitis and early death, 2011, a Salver study that's done in Sweden. And they looked at 1.2 million people from 1985 to 2009, and only 10,000 of them met the criteria that they had lost a tooth by the age of 40. So they looked for tooth loss by the age of 40, and they looked at how long these people lived. Now, if you're losing a tooth at 40, Steve, we know you're ill. You're a very sick person. However, women live 36 years less than average, and men 31 years less than average. Gum disease kills. And, you know, it's a chronic inflammatory, vascular, gingival, bony, systemic disease. And I think microbiological testing is necessary. If you've got persistent bleeding, you need to inform the patient about an infection. And this is to protect us as well in making a diagnosis. And I think you discuss later antibiotic, microfilm, biofilm modalities to address the infection. So their quote was that periodontitis is a risk marker for premature death. Long-term chronic inflammation and microbial burden cause widespread systemic effects. Identifying the bacteria responsible for the disease and causing death is critical. Public health consequences create the need for prophylactic measures, and these are warranted. Early treatments required. That's frightening when you read that literally periodontal disease is killing people, and that's the first study I've seen detailing it. Third one was it's called low abundance biofilm species orchestrates. I got to read this: inflammatory periodontal disease and commensurate bacteria, done by NIH in November 2011. And for the very first time, we have a cause for periodontal disease. What they said is that B. gingivalis blocks two receptors on white blood cells, and they can't be detected then, the P. gingivalis, by the white blood cells. So they bred sterile mice, and they gave them P. gingivalis alone, no periodontal disease. They gave them commensurate bacteria alone, no periodontal disease. And they gave them both, and they got periodontal disease. They took similar sterile mice, but they had these receptors altered so that the P. gingivalis could not block them. And when they got P. gingivalis alone, again, no periodontal disease. They gave them the commensurate bacteria, no periodontal disease. They gave them both, no periodontal disease. And that was because the body could fight P. gingivalis. And so their statement, and I quote, is P. gingivalis is the keystone bacteria causing periodontal disease. It's a chronic inflammatory systemic disease. Early treatment is needed. Targeting P. gingivalis, and you target P. gingivalis and you control periodontal disease. And right now, metronidazole is about the only drug that will do that. You can use it as a rinse to catch early stage, and there are several types I can go over later on. Lisa talked about this study from the Journal of Neuroinflammation 2011, Alzheimer's, a neurosparaketosis. And to put it in perspective, Lyme disease is caused by spirochete, and in 24% of the cases that where they develop dementia, this spirochete is found in the brain. Syphilis is also caused by spirochete, and at the third stage, dementia, 100% of the lesions look like AD, and they have the same spirochete in the lesions. And what they found when they did this study is they found five of the trypanoma species in the brain lesions of 93% of the patients with Alzheimer's. And this is exactly the same type of bacteria that causes periodontal disease. So spirochetes can cause Lyme disease and syphilis, and spirochetes in lesions of the brain may be causing Alzheimer's. What they indicated is that there's a probable causal relationship between this neurospirochetosis and Alzheimer's. Spirochetal infection occurs years or decades before the manifestations of Alzheimer's. Inadequate antibiotic and anti-inflammatory therapies are available, as in syphilis, one might prevent and eradicate dementia. I think that's unbelievable that gum disease could be the cause of Alzheimer's and we can prevent it. And it brings into mind, again, microbiology and antibiotic therapy as required.
There is a common thread here, isn't there?
There
it's
certainly
all bugs.
Is. And well, and I think that's why I'm saying it's about biofilm control. Yes, we do a lot of therapies, but we do a lot of therapies to treat the effects of it. And the final one's very interesting concerning Bronge. Bronge is bisphosphonate-related osteonecrosis of the jaw. And what they're saying is that, and quoting, the prevention and management of Bronge may require the use of anti-biofilm modalities to target AA, yeast, and gram-negative biofilms, which are found in Bronge. Biofilms play an important role in the pathogenesis of Bronge. Most cases of Bronge occur because the bacteria that are in the mouth have easy access to the bone after trauma or extractions. Cancer patients, you know, they heal poorly, and the bacteria found do cause bone loss and destruction in periodontal disease, and it smells. It's a gram-negative anaerobic biofilm. So what they're saying is that targeting the gram-negative anaerobic biofilm, AA, and yeast will, they believe, help to prevent bisphosphonate-related osteonecrosis of the jaw. And again, in antibiotic mouthwashes, one I recommend has amoxicillin, nystatin, and metronidazole, which will target all of those. Finally, when we take a look at things like hip, knee, valve, pre-implant surgery, again, these are biofilm issues. We give the pre-medication for hip, knee, and valve and implant surgery because we're trying to control the biofilm. But the antibiotic we give is amoxicillin, and amoxicillin is not one that's going to tackle gram-negative biofilms. And unfortunately, in most cases, it's not going to build up a level in the mouth and the saliva that can be effective. But again, if you use an antibiotic mouthwash prior to patients having hip, knee, valve replacement or implants, you may be able to control biofilms and make them systemically healthy and in implant cases, improve the result of your implant care. So biofilms matter, Steve, and that's where my emphasis has been for a period of time now for the last 7 years, and I wanted our CC dentists to consider putting a real focus on that because it's what treats and prevents most of the diseases that we take care of.
There is a big connection, and with the aging of the population, you got demographics in your favor that more and more people are looking at their total health and the connection and are willing and want to talk about it more than they ever have before. So got a lot of good things in your favor, don't you?
I think as well, if we're not doing these things or not recommending these things, I think we put ourselves significantly at risk for lawsuits in the future. It's not that you want to practice with your looking over your back. And in dentistry, we don't have as much an issue as perhaps they do in the States. But, I mean, I'm seeing the personal injury lawyers on TV routinely and on the radio talking about, have you been damaged? Has this happened to you? You may have a cause. Give us a call. And I think it behooves us to try and stay out of that situation. The last thing I think to know is that I wanted to tell the story of Oravital. The founder was the very first person to recommend antibiotic rinses in 1996, Ann Bosey, to control breath odor and periodontal disease. And I do need to declare a conflict of interest because, as I discussed the concept, as I do own shares in Aura Vital, I was the first dentist that she contacted to be involved with the company. And it is a method for controlling periodontal disease, breath, odor, decay, because decay is a biofilm and can be affected by antibiotics as well. And as I mentioned, it can be used to consider bronch, hip and knee, valve replacement, and early implant failure by using microtesting and antibiotic rinses. Anne had her training at the U of T. She got her microbiological training in oral breath odor, and she studied for 3 years there. She was the head of George Brown College. She's a hygienist, and she was responsible for the overall programs for 20 years. And she told me that based on her studies and private practice, limited to breath odor for 15 years, the breath odor in 98% of the cases was caused by the same bacteria that caused periodontal disease. And I kind of knew that, but in dental school, if most of the dentists are like me, we learn very little about how to control breath odor. And she said that 98% of the time it's caused by the bacteria, and there are exceptions with things like alcohol, food, cancer, hunger, morning breath, and even a genetic disease called trimethyl, and I can pronounce it, amyluria, which is a persistent fishy smell. And that foul odor was an oral condition, and at times it was coming from the back of the tongue down the throat, and that this is an area where you couldn't disturb the biofilm. And if you can't, the bacteria break down protein and produce the odors that we know of. An interesting thing she told me was a five-second test to see if the odors are coming from the back of the tongue. And all you have to do is take your mirror, touch the back of the tongue as it goes down the throat for about 1 second, let it dry for 10 seconds and smell. And if you can't find where the odor's coming from, that's often where it is. Like Tommy, she had done biofilm sampling since 1990, before and after breath care in over 5,000 patients. And she'd had a 95% success rate in treating them. So when she told me that she was getting that sort of success with breath odor, I said, what are the gums like? And she said, based on her study, 641 patients, where it was done, analysis done at the University of Michigan under Dr. Walter Loesch, with a 1 in 10,000 chance of error, 84% reduction in bleeding and similar shrinkage by using antibiotic mouthwashes. And this was something that we had not started doing, and recently Crown Council has mentioned it as well. And she said that she'd compounded these rinses over the years, and I'll go over the ingredients in a minute, and that they had very few systemic effects, and that they're far better than oral dose for mild to moderate periodontal and breath care. So if we could take a minute and talk about the concept of rinses, microbial sampling and products that are in rinses that you could consider and why they're in and what they do. What's your experience been with rinses with Steve with Tom and the response from the dentist that they've been using?
Pretty essential part of the overall treatment protocol, so very essential.
Yeah, and I think, again, if we think of that idea of treating ulcers, you have to realize it's an infection, and you don't treat the symptoms. If you can control the study and it indicates P. gingivalis, then you control periodontal disease. If you control step mutans, you control decay. So it's within our reach to get our patients healthy. So when you look at a rinse, in the rinses we use metronidazole, and it's an antibiotic that targets the cell wall. There is no known resistance, and it does not, in a rinse form, cause a stomach upset, whereas an oral dose will. When you take an antibiotic like metronidazole that's more concentrated, we worry about yeast overgrowth, at least women do when it comes to their lives in general. So we started combining nystatin in it, which controls yeast that's present in most cases as well. And it also targets the cell walls and weakens them so that the metronidazole works more effectively. And interestingly, metronidazole will also target and kill amoebas. And we don't look at amoebas, but when you look at resistant refractory periodontal disease in the microfilm slides that we look at, we routinely find amoebas. And finally, for situations where there's hip and knee valve replacement, and if I'm doing pre-implant treatment, we've added amoxicillin to tackle the AA bacteria and the strep bacteria that are associated with those diseases. As well, the chlorhexidine we use is a 0.2 versus a 0.12. Anne did a study on her patients where they were under breath control using, at that point, only chlorhexidine, kind of the old OxyFresh method CDLX, Closus, and chlorhexidine. But she found that 0.2% is 65% more effective, and the rinses can be compounded if they're made properly, but they don't stain the way chlorhexidine normally does. So those are chemicals to consider, but the antibiotics to consider, the metronidazole, nystatin, and amoxicillin in your rinses. In combination, they seem to work well. What's the acceptance been like for the oral DNA in the States, Steve?
It's good in the practices where they've got good systems in place to explain it to the patient and set it up right in the entire context of treating the disease. So, as you know, the testing is not the answer, but it's part of the answer, and
exactly.
So it fits within a total treatment protocol.
And I think what you've stated is the difficulty in that to put all this into place, you have to engage a system that the patient understands what's in it for me. And I've mentioned a number of things that you can do, and from other practitioners we can learn from them as well. And the more we learn, the easier it will be for us to adopt microbiological testing. Now, there's oral DNA and the vital microbiological are third party proof of disease or that the patient's at risk. And I find that, you know, when the doctor comes in with the stethoscope and says, I'd looked at your analysis and you have an infection, and I can prescribe an antibiotic, there isn't a patient that says, I don't want to do that. When you discuss with them that they have an infection and that you can prescribe an antibiotic mouthwash that has problems and may bring it under control, most patients are going to say yes. So I think that the testing helps the patient accept what's done. This is after the fact. Both are about a two-minute sampling technique. Differences might be that with the Orovital, we sample the actual bacteria and do a Gram stain. So we can do site-specific testing both between the teeth and on the tongue if you're doing breath. And the oral DNA is going to pick up in the saliva, so the bacteria may be more free-floating than the actual depiction of the bacteria in the actual pockets themselves. And also it'll show amoeba, yeast, and white blood cells, which I'm not sure picked up with oral DNA. So just a couple of differences in those. And finally, the understanding, I think, of the difference between an oral rinse and oral pill and why Tommy and I are recommending oral rinses. Rinses are non-diluted. And what I'm going to say might sound toxic, but I'll put it in perspective in a moment. When you rinse with an antibiotic, you get 3,000 to 4,000 times the concentration of an oral dose. What does that mean? For an oral dose, you have to get 1,000 times the dose that you would in the saliva that you would get by having it in the bloodstream to be able to break down a biofilm. And you just can't take enough oral to break down biofilms. When you rinse with it, you get 3,000 to 4,000 times the concentration. So you're well able to penetrate biofilms. But I want to imagine you empty a pill on your tongue, you swish and you spit or rinse, and at that point you have 100% antibiotic in the mouth. And that's all you're really doing with the rinse. And then you can swallow it if you want, which is an oral dose, or you can spit it out. We recommend spitting it out. But the pill is diluted in the whole body. It dissolves in the fluid from the top of your head to the, you know, to your toes. And it works best on late periodontal disease because it's designed to be carried through the bloodstream, reach around the roots, get to the bone. But at that point, the disease is already there. So you have less systemic effects with the swish and spit. You don't have to worry about alcohol consumption, because unless in an extreme case of a deeply fissured tongue where the stuff might remain in the tongue, you won't be swallowing it. A powdered formulation works sometimes a bit better than a rinse, because the particles will stick to the tissue, get into the sulcus, and they give you a time release. I want you to think of Arestin, which is a system that delivers the localized antibiotic under the sulcus. And it works extremely well, but the difference with a rinse is rather than treating a single site, you can treat the entire mouth. You're talking about the tongue, the throat, the sulcus, the teeth, the gums, and it does it for less price than Arestin does. Low dose, less resistance as more bacteria are killed. And the challenge is that in spite of our best efforts and therapies, we're having problems controlling biofilms. So please consider the antibiotic use, the rinses. Early intervention is the key. All the systemic effects that we mentioned are important, and I think they drive us to change how we're practicing.
Well, Jim, we can tell you are you are into that in a big way, and definitely the way dentistry is going, and certainly a lot to learn to be able to implement it correctly in your practice, but making a big difference in people's lives as you do that. So thanks for sharing that with us. As we wrap up here, give us your additional things to consider before we finish up.
Well, I would hope that some of the Crown Council members might consider Orovital as a treatment method, both for microbiological sampling and rinsing. We're willing to give a free set of rinses and microbiological testing to you and a patient if you want. You can access this on a continuing basis, ongoing basis, at no charge if you'd like to. But if dentists or offices would like to be on the website for referrals for perio and breath care, then there is a training that we have to do, an NDA that has to be signed. It just stops people from copying the system that we use. Our rinses are patent pending. If you're looking at breath care, one clinic that we have earned over $500,000 a year just doing breath care, and that's in just a major city like Toronto. So we think that we'd like to establish some clinics throughout the U.S. These are non-OxyFresh methods, and they truly do work. They want to get more information, they can contact me, email me at drjimhyland@gmail.com, or vital, www.orvital.com, and phone direct, 800-324-8675. So Steve, that's really what I wanted to bring to the table today, for us to think about biofilms and anti-biofilm modalities, and the fact that our patients need this type of care, because many of the diseases that make our lives so difficult can be maybe intercepted and prevented by doing good dental care.
Excellent. Jim, thanks so much for sharing your years of wisdom today in both the clinical and the management side of dentistry, and appreciate your ongoing input and sharing your wisdom online with the Crown Council email network and all you continue to do. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity, Steve.